had your Bible there, you can... I'm way too loud for that close.
I did prepare an outline that's available now, so I gave it to the people that had specifically requested, but Sam Schnarr has a copy. So if you would like a copy of the outline to go along while I'm talking, raise your hand, don't be shy. Sam will get that. And then there's some on the back as well. So Sam will walk around. Just keep your hand up till you get it, and Sam will take care of that for us. I appreciate it. Just don't expect what I say to perfectly match all of the ideas and the scriptures, but there's I don't have the outline up here, just to give you. I've got my notes, which is basically the same. Just hard to put arrows and stuff like I like to do on an outline. But if you don't need one now, there will be some on the back, and of course we'll email those out as well as we do. As Sam's doing that, it's one thing I've observed the last few weeks that I just wanted to comment is I love the noise of the kids. I love the noise of the kids, the crying, the screaming, the laughing, the giggling, the talking when they shouldn't be, the loud whispering. Mainly I love that because I know that means there's parents who probably haven't heard a real sermon for years, but you're doing a lot of hard, good work being here, and I really appreciate that. Christine and I were fortunate to, I think, be past that stage where most of the time we really get to pay attention, which is a blessing. But all of you parents doing that work, I really appreciate it with those young children. So if you weren't here last week, Abe did a fantastic job of setting up the month, looking at the Nile River of holiness throughout Scripture, specifically looking at how God has always desired a holy people. In fact, it's completely our origin, isn't it? That He created us in His image to be holy. And then we looked at, I mean, just this whirlwind tour of all of the work God has put in so that we can stand before Him, so that we can approach Him as holy, so that He can dwell among us and that we can be a holy people. He's always wanted a holy people to bear His image. God is inherently holy. I hope we understand that. It's not that God chooses. It's sort of like, I didn't choose to have red hair. I mean, nowadays, my kids, my two little ones, they get complimented all the time. It wasn't that way when I was their age. There was all sorts of names that I got called and got picked on because I had red hair, but I had nothing to do with it. I didn't, like, you know what, Mom? I think I would really like red hair. Well, God is holy because of who He is. In fact, in Revelation chapter 4, which is, and I appreciate RJ reading. In fact, RJ, I want you to record the whole Bible. I mean, there's something about his pace and his voice. I'm like, I didn't really get used to this, right? In Revelation chapter 4, we have this throne scene. And what I want us to do with this as we launch from here is I want us to consider what... So God is holy. In fact, it is the foundation. It's inherent to who He is. It's the foundation of all of His other characteristics. Abe said it somewhat differently, but pretty much the same way I'm going to say it is. When we think about God, if I said, give me an attribute of God, tell me who God is, holy might be there, but love would also be there. Merciful would be there. Grace, compassion, kindness, justice, wisdom, all those things would be there, but I would submit to you that all those things are special and come to mind because first and foremost, God is holy. He has holy love. He has holy grace. He has holy mercy, holy justice, holy wisdom. They are otherly. They are set apart. They are utterly unique. That's why we're so in awe when we think of something like love and forgiveness when we think about our God and how He demonstrated, because it's so beyond our comprehension, our capacity to truly understand the depths of it, because He is holy. But what is it about Him that is so different? In Revelation chapter 4, I submit to you that we have sort of the foundation of His holiness, if I could use those terms. So you have this great throne room scene. And what we're going to lock in just as we launch off into our discussion here is verse 8. So you have these creatures. And I hope you did what RJ suggested and you just used your imagination. And you have these creatures and look what's happening in verse 8. So you have the throne room and these creatures and the four living creatures, each one of them having six wings and full of eyes around and within. And day and night they do not cease to say. Now, first of all, before we read what they say, day and night they don't cease. That tells us something about the significance of what they're saying. As if that being in the presence of God demands something crying. It reminds me of when Jesus is walking, and if we try to quiet them, the stones will cry out, right? That God's presence, He is so holy, He is so otherly, He is so utterly unique, that being in His presence demands this being cried out day and night without ceasing. And they cry out, verse 8, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and who is and who is to come." And as they're crying that out day and night without ceasing, and when, verse 9, the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to Him who sits on the throne, to Him who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders will fall down before Him who sits on the throne and will worship Him who lives forever and ever and will cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are You, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for You created all things, and because of Your will they existed and were created." Do you notice what's called out about God? Do you notice what the creatures emphasize when they say, "Holy, holy, holy"? They say, "Holy, holy, holy, God, Lord God, the Almighty, who was and is who is to come." And then when the elders throw down their crowns in response to the creatures calling, "Holy, holy, holy," they remark, yes, His eternal nature, but also, and He created everything. So right there in this scene, you see this foundation of what sets God apart, what makes Him so otherly, what demands that He has these creatures 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is probably not a good reference because there is no time. But without ceasing, day and night, crying, "Holy, holy," it's because He's eternal. He has no beginning. He has no end. We can sort of wrap our minds around the concept of no end, right? We can look, but none of us can even comprehend the idea of not having a beginning. But God has no beginning. And He, all things exist. Everything you think about, every breath you take, every thought you have, everything you see, touch, feel, hear, all of it was created, brought into existence, bringing something from nothing because of the power of our eternal Creator. That's why God is otherly. That's the basis. And it's interesting, if we think about our first introduction to God, Genesis 1:1, do you realize those thoughts are right there? In the beginning, our beginning, there was God. So before our beginning, God speaks to His eternal nature right there. And what did that God do? In the beginning, our beginning, God. Our beginning is only there because God created. Turn over to John chapter 1. We're going to be in the Gospel of John quite a bit tonight. I'm going to go way longer than an hour and a half, Abe. So I'm already talking about tonight. There's a lot of packages to unpackage, Abe. So, in John chapter 1, when John introduces Jesus, you see the exact same kind of language, don't you? It's a more expanded version where Genesis 1:1 introduces us to, in the beginning, God created. John 1:1 through 3, John says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has not come into being." It's a lot of words to say, in the beginning, Jesus created. Right? In the beginning, before there was, Jesus was. In the beginning, before we ever existed, before there was a beginning, Jesus. And what did He do? He created. And so you see that the foundation of God's holy throne is this eternal Creator, and you see who Jesus is this eternal Creator. Now here's where there's the separation. Here's where Jesus is set apart, you might say, where Jesus is set apart. Look down at chapter 1, verse 14. John chapter 1, verse 14. "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw His glory, glory as the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now try to take that Revelation 4 throne room scene. Try to take that picture. Maybe Isaiah 6, if you want to go there. Same concept, same ideas, very similar. Picture being in that context, and that those creatures crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who is and who was and who is and who is to come." And the elders responding and throwing, and worthy are you because you created all things, and because of you all things exist. Picture that in all its unfathomableness. Is that a word? It is now. Picture that and think of that becoming flesh. Take a hand and pinch yourself. Do it. Just pull some skin. Some of you it'll pull a little farther. Some all of that put on flesh. That holy, eternal Creator put on flesh. And notice that word. And I hope as soon as I read that, you immediately went back to Abe, specifically last week, his in-between. He put on flesh, and what did he do? He dwelt among us. Remember when Abe was talking about the in-between, he was talking about Genesis 3:8, and I would even expand it. Genesis, God in the garden, he's walking among his creation. He's walking among his children who he created in his image. It's the ideal state. God immediately in your presence. And then he said, and you go all the way to Leviticus chapter 26, verse 11 and 12, where if you keep my commandments, here's the promises. And what was that? That I will walk, that I will dwell among you, and I will walk among you. And Abe talked about all the stuff, and I'm not going to reread it. It's in the notes that we sent out this week. All the stuff from the ideal state and all the sin that took place and what God did so that he could again walk among. And now add this layer. In fact, I did print this out. Abe said that all that in between, Genesis 3:8 and Leviticus 26, 11 and 12, is God trying to get back to the original image bearer state of creation to dwell with his people that the world may know him. And now that God has put on flesh so that he can dwell among his creation. Do you see how significant? Do you see how significant it is in the scheme, in the plan, in the consistency, and that this holy people is the reason we exist, created in His image, so that we can bear His image, because He wants so desperately to be among us, to dwell with us, so that we can be in His presence. And so now, this morning, what we're going to explore is how this eternal Creator became flesh and dwelt among us. And what did it look like as He dwelt among us? Go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 26. I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong one. Luke chapter 8. We're going to look at two passages just real quickly. Luke chapter 8, and we're going to look at John chapter 8. In Luke chapter 8, we're still in this realm of eternal Creator. Just keep that thought in your mind. Eternal Creator. Luke chapter 8, verse 22. This is a story that I learned way back when I was a little tot. It's one of a lot of our kids' favorite stories. In Luke chapter 8, we're just going to pick up in verse 22. Now on one of those days, Jesus and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." So they launched out. But as they were sailing along, he fell asleep, and a fierce gale of wind descended on the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger. They came to Jesus and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Have you ever been among rambunctious, rowdy children? Sort of opened our sermon that way, didn't I? I got some of them here. Rambunctious, rowdy children who maybe they just had one too many cupcakes and they're a little excited, just happy to be alive. And the noise level and the playing, we had our study on Friday night, and I didn't count, but we probably had 12 kids, 13 kids. A lot of them real little kids. Poor Katie. Not poor Katie. Thank you, Katie. Katie's taking care of those while the adults study, and it's just amazing the work she does. But that she comes up, she just looks like she's been beaten down, right? But Katie's down there, and every now and then the noise level gets a little higher. But you've been around kids, and the excitement. What happens when dad raises the volume? I'm not talking about yelling, but when dad raises the volume of his voice to be heard over the noise. Oftentimes, right? whew, sort of the picture you get here. I'm being a little bit silly, but Jesus is sleeping. His disciples are screaming and yelling because they think that because it's a severe storm. And these are again, we've had this point made before. These are fishermen. It's not because they just, oh no, I saw fish, and they're scared. I mean, it's a dangerous situation. You almost like Jesus just like be quiet. And I don't know I'm not suggesting his tone, but be quiet. Because there's authority there, isn't there? He is the eternal creator. He is the creator, and he just rebuked his creation. How many other miracles can you think of? I'm not going to let you raise your hand, but how many other miracles can you think of where Jesus in the flesh, dwelling among us, displays his authority and his control over creation? Water into wine? Maybe when he raises someone from the dead? Maybe think through, take a minute to just think through all of those displays where Jesus in the flesh, dwelling among us, displays authority over his creation. And I love this account because it's literally like, hey kid, be quiet. Dad telling the child to be quiet. And creation goes, whoop. And the disciples' response is, who is this? Who is this that even the wind and the storm and the waves obey him? Go ahead and turn to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. John chapter 8. Now there's this whole, it's so hard for me to not develop this whole context. This is such a great discussion, and where there's a discussion of who's your father and who's your father, and you're, if you were children of Abraham, you would, and all this discussion that Jesus is having between the Jewish authority, and it's a divisive discussion. And towards the accumulation of that, as we jump down to John chapter 8, verse 56, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. So Jesus tells them, your father Abraham, who they're claiming to be their father, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old and you have seen Abraham? You can almost hear just like the ridicule. I mean, okay, young whippersnapper. You're not even 50 and you've seen Abraham. Verse 58. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, no matter how I read this, it's not going to do it justice. Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. And you see their reaction. They pick up stones to throw him, to throw at him. It says, therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. They picked up stones because when he said, before Abraham was, I am, they immediately thought about Exodus. Chapter 3, where Moses is before the burning bush, and God in the burning bush is telling Moses to go to Pharaoh, and he says, why in the world would he see me? And he says, go to the people, tell them, and Moses says, "Who? I'm going to go before Israel, and I'm going to say, the God of our fathers, who should I tell him sent me? Do you remember his answer? Tell them, I am sent you. So Jesus, dwelling in the flesh, he shows complete control over nature. He shows that he is the creator in the flesh. And here he's making this very bold claim that he is not only the creator in the flesh, but he has always existed. Yes, he's making himself out to be God the Father, one with God the Father. But he's also making a claim that before Abraham was, I am. He is holy and eternal, just like God the Father. But there's also another aspect of Jesus in the flesh. And Abe brought this up last time. In fact, I don't know if you're still in John chapter 1, but in that introduction of who Jesus is in John chapter 1, the disciple John says in verse 18, he says, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. He has explained him. So Jesus in the flesh has explained who the Father is. If you remember in John chapter 14, I believe it is, when Philip says, show us the Father, it's enough. And do you remember what Jesus' response is? I've been with you this whole time, and you say, show us the Father? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Hebrews 1 says it like this, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us, in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he has also made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. He is the exact representation of his nature. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. This is Colossians 1, 15 through 17. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in the heavens and on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So notice, even in this exact representation, he is the exact representation, he is the image of the invisible God, it still references eternal creator. Jesus in the flesh, representing the eternal creator. I want us to explore just for the next couple minutes what that means when it comes to the law. So if you remember what Abe said, he said specifically Leviticus. In fact, I think he said he had a note written. He tried to claim that he didn't say smart enough. He said you couldn't summarize enough, I think, right? He says, Leviticus, a holy God graciously providing a way for his set apart people to live in his presence. The law. You can look at the law, that's one way to think of it, is a holy God graciously providing a way for his set apart people to live in his presence. I shouldn't have said or, I should have also said and. And a way for his set apart people to approach him. So if we're considering Jesus, the holy God in the flesh, the eternal creator in the flesh, dwelling among us, not only should we think about his interactions and his conduct and the way he talked and the experiences he had and all those things that show how it is that God's creation, God's children should live and behave on this earth. But I think it's also important for us to understand his relationship to the law. Because as God provided Israel the law so that they could approach him, his holy presence, so that they could live in his holy presence, or that he could dwell among them, I think there's some interesting things that we can look at when we consider Jesus. Now, this is just going to be very, very brief in our discussion. We're not going to delve into this too deeply, but turn to Leviticus chapter 15. That's the first one I'm going to read from the text, and you can read Numbers up here on the book. I want to look at just three aspects from the law and then parallel that with Jesus. Numbers chapter 5. I can't do two things at once. I need to be quiet and turn my Bible. Does anybody else go through the song in their head when they're... I do, even for something like Leviticus. Numbers chapter 5, 2 and 3 says, "Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. You shall send away both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst." Okay, so you have three things discussed here. Discharges, you have dead people, you have leprosy, right? And the instruction is if there's somebody suffering from those, they've touched a dead person or they have leprosy or they're suffering from a discharge, send them outside the camp. They need to be outside the camp so that they won't defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. Okay. This is all written in the Bible, so if you have a complaint about some of the words I read, you can talk to God later about it. Leviticus 15:19. And then after this, we'll read Numbers 19:11, and you'll see we're coming back to Leviticus, so you might keep your thumb there. Then we'll go to the Matthew passages. Leviticus 15:19. "When a woman has a discharge, her discharge in her body is blood. She shall continue in her menstrual impurity for 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening." So it's not just send them outside, whoever touches, right? So then it affects not just the person who has the condition or is in the situation, but whoever touches. Numbers chapter 19. Hang with me through some of these get a little tedious, I think, at times. 19 verse 11. "The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days, that one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died, and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water of impurity was not sprinkled on him, he shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. So notice it's not just touching a corpse, but if you go into the tent of a dead person, then there's some instructions on what you have to do because you're unclean so that you can then again be among the people where God dwells, right? So that you can go to start to again participate in those things. Now let's finish up our Leviticus in chapter 13. Here we're talking about leprosy. Now notice in chapter 13, verse 45 and 46, here's the instructions to the leper. As for the leper who has the infection, his clothes shall be torn and the hair of his head shall be uncovered, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, "Unclean, unclean!" He shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. So here the person who is afflicted with leprosy has to do certain things to identify himself as unclean, and then he has to go and be alone outside the camp. All right? Now, as you drop down to chapter 14, when they're clean, this is not then when the leper's clean. Look what happens in 14, verse 1. Trust me, we're going to bring all this to a really strong conclusion in just a moment. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This shall be the law of the leper in the day of his cleansing. Now he shall be brought to the priest." Now, I'm not going to comment on this now, but I want you to pay special attention to verse 3 and then to verse 7. "Now he shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall go out to the outside of the camp. Thus the priest shall look, and if the infection of leprosy has been healed in the leper, then the priest shall give orders to take two live clean birds and cedar wood and a scarlet string and hyssop." So you see, outside the priest is to go outside the camp to the leper, and he takes a sacrifice. Go ahead and read. It's interesting. There's a whole lot of symbolism there that we're not getting into. But notice, once the priest decides he's clean, he's done that sacrifice, there's another sacrifice comes place. But look at verse 11. See, I said verse 7. Pay attention to verse 11. "And the priest who pronounces him clean shall present the man to be cleansed and the aforesaid before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting." So this, I'll comment on this more clearly in a second. But so with the leper, he's supposed to do things to show himself unclean. That's very obvious. He goes outside the camp, just like these others we've talked about. But then the priest, once he's been cleansed, the priest goes outside the camp to him, offers a sacrifice, does a cleansing there, and then brings him before the tent of the Lord, the tabernacle, and presents him as clean. Okay, you got that? That's the structure. Go to Matthew chapter 9 now. Nobody's asleep yet, so that's good. It was an early morning for all of us. Matthew chapter 9, verse 20 through 23. And behold... "A woman who had suffered from a discharge of blood for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and she said to herself, 'If I only touch his garment, I will be made well.' Jesus turned and seeing her said, 'Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well.' And instantly the woman was made well." Verse 23. "And when Jesus came to the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making commotion, he said, 'Go away, for the girl is not dead, but sleeping.' And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl arose, and the report on this went throughout the whole district." Now flip back to chapter 8, 1 through 4. "And when Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him, and a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, 'See that you tell no one, but go show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them.'" Okay, notice, some of you have already seen this connection. Notice what's happening with Jesus in the flesh. Under the law, what had to happen? Under the law, if I had a discharge, and I only read 15:19, before that it talks about if a man has a discharge. I don't want to think you ladies think I'm picking on you. But if there was a situation, you had all these things, you had to go outside the camp, and you had all these things that you had to do in order to be clean, so that then you could come back in the midst of the people and present yourself before God. Whether it was leprosy, whether it was a discharge, whether it was you'd been, you know, your loved one had died and you touched the corpse, or you were just in the room with the corpse. Notice what we just read. A woman with a discharge touches Jesus. He doesn't scold her and say, "I'm unclean." He says, "Woman, your faith has made you well." The daughter dies. They laugh at him because he goes, "She's only sleeping." What's he do? He walks into the tent, into her room, and he touches her. The leper comes and bows down before him and says, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." Jesus doesn't run away screaming because he's going to be impure or unclean. He reaches out and he touches him. The holy God in the flesh, where the law of Moses provided for God's people to clean and purify themselves so that they could approach him, Jesus, holiness in the flesh, sought out the unclean and defiled. He reached out and touched the sinner, his holiness purifying and cleaning. Isaiah 6 should immediately come to your mind. Where Isaiah is in the throne room of God, he's in the presence of God, and woe is me, I'm ruined, from a man of unclean lips, and I'm from a people of unclean lips. And what happened? God casts him out. God's holiness just springs out from the throne and burns him to a crisp. Now the creature takes a coal out of the altar and goes to Isaiah and touches his lips and says, "You're clean. Your sins have been forgiven." See, this is what we need to understand about God in the flesh. Jesus, the eternal creator, holiness in the flesh, is that his holiness is radiating out from the Holy of Holies. It's radiating out from the temple. It is coming and looking for the unclean and the undefiled, and his purity is purifying us. His holiness is making us holy. In fact, if you go to Hebrews chapter 7, now, this is, Christine will tell you, I struggled all day yesterday with trying to figure out how to sum this up. Basically, you need to go home and read the whole book of Hebrews. Maybe Hebrews 7 through 10 might work. But see, it's not just that Jesus interacted with and touched the unclean, and he touched the defiled, and he touched the sinful, and he sought after in order to purify and make holy that which was unholy according to the law. But he's also our high priest. In Hebrews chapter 7, I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit more of the context than what's on the screen. In Hebrews chapter 7, let's start in verse 23. The former priests, now he's arguing about the whole priesthood of Melchizedek. The former priests, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. But Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make an intercession for them. For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men as high priests who are weak, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints a son made perfect forever. If you read through Hebrews 7 through 10 and you start thinking about our high priest and how it differs from the priestly order that was under Aaron, The differences are astonishing. We have such a high priest. Not only do you read these words like who doesn't need daily because he's innocent, he's holy, he's undefiled, separated, but he didn't just go into the Holy of Holies once a year, did he? He went into the presence of God itself, Hebrews says. And he didn't go in with some less than perfect or less than... I completely lost the word. Less than ideal, less than worthy sacrifice, some blood of bulls and goats that's not able to cleanse you. He went in taking his own flesh. He was both the high priest and the lamb. And he goes into the very presence of God for us, taking his own blood as the atoning sacrifice. Now think about what I said in Leviticus. I said I was going to come back here, right? Think about what we've just read about in Leviticus. I think I went the wrong direction. Nope, I've completely didn't put that slide in there, I think is what the problem is. No, there we go, sorry. Whew, got ahead of myself. Now you know how it ends. Think about that picture we had with the leper in Leviticus chapter 14. I think it was 14, yeah, chapter 14. Notice that the leper had to go outside the camp because he was unclean. Where did the priest go? Did the priest stay in the camp and wait for the leper to come and say, I'm clean? The priest went outside the camp and sacrificed. And then what did the priest do? Then the priest brought the now clean leper into the presence of God. Let me get the wording right. He brought the unclean leper to the tent of meeting, to the tabernacle, to present him before the Lord. Colossians 1, 21 and 22. Although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death in order to present you before him holy and blameless and beyond reproach. The eternal creator, Jesus Christ in the flesh, holiness in the flesh, came to us outside the camp in our filthy, disgusting, sinful state, enemies of God. And his sacrifice enabled him to present us holy and blameless and above reproach. That's the picture, one of the pictures that the law is painting for us. To understand that that is exactly what Christ is doing for us, but he's doing it in a way that we couldn't have ever possibly imagined. We couldn't have fathomed. As we close, I want us to consider this. I want us to consider this. If you are willing, I'm not going to read the text, so you're not even going to know. You'll have some idea of where these came from. But I want you to keep your eyes closed if you're willing to do that as I read this. Here are some of the statements we looked at when it talked about he is the exact representation. So if you summed up a lot of where we focused this morning, and he is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. He's the image of the invisible, the firstborn of all creation. For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read, and what I've tried to do is place together some of the events of what it was that Jesus did outside the camp. When he was marched out of Jerusalem, carrying his cross, so that he could be crucified outside the camp. But I'm going to set it with these phrases in between those that language. Does that make sense? We often read the crucifixion account, but I want us to read other true statements about who Jesus in the flesh was as we consider. So if you're comfortable with it, shut your eyes, and we're going to be done right after this. He is the radiance of his glory. When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. He is the exact representation of his nature. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any, for many were giving false testimony against him. But their testimony was not consistent. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" They all condemned him to be deserving death. Some began to spit at him and blindfolded him and beat him with their fists and to say to him, "Prophesy." And the officers received him with slaps in the face. He is the image of the invisible God. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus. He had wanted to see him for a long time because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. He is such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. I found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him, nor has Herod. For he sent him back to us, and behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the king of the Jews? So they cried out again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. He is the radiance of his glory. The soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort. They dressed him in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him, and they began to acclaim him, Hail, King of the Jews! And they kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him, and kneeling and bowing before him. He's the exact representation of his nature. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they crucified him, and the soldiers divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over him there, and above his head they put up the charge against him, which read, This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left, and those passing hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself! If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him and saying, He saved others, he can't save himself. He is the King of Israel, let him come down from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God, let God receive him now, if he delights in him. For he said, I am the Son of God. The robbers who had been crucified with him were also insulting him with the same words. He is the image of the invisible God. When the sixth hour came, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? And when some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, Behold, he is calling for Elijah. Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink, saying, Let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. He is such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. That's how we treated holiness in the flesh. When our eternal Creator left the throne of God and put on flesh, so that he could dwell among us because he so desperately wanted a holy people. We responded with hate and mocking and ridicule. And we strung him to a cross. But Jesus can sympathize with our weaknesses. He did all of that so that he could relate to us. So that he could understand our situation and he could be the mediator that we need. And so this morning, if you're feeling lost, if you're feeling separated, if you feel like you're outside the camp, you can boldly, with confidence, petition the throne of God because of what Jesus in the flesh did for us. If we can help you this morning, please come forward while we stand and sing.